Well, as you have caught on by now, I'm the Donna of Donna and Jackie. Thank you for inviting Jackie and I to spend some time with you as you continue on your sacred journey of finding the settled minister for Theodore Parker Unitarian Universalist Church. It was difficult for me to imagine joining you this morning in the wake of the events in Boston. Our world has been so full of loss, change, hope, and courage, the landscape of our lives changing all the time. I'm humbled to share your worship space and time. I wondered over the last couple of weeks, in what way can we frame our time today to embrace the culture of love, healing, and hope, as so eloquently captured in the words of Theodore Parker himself. Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere, its temple all space, its shrine the good heart, its creed all truth, its ritual works of love, its profession of faith, divine living. So it is in the spirit that I join you today to share a perspective about how beyond categorical thinking can hold your process of the search, which is pretty specific and time-limited, and carry us to a place of how we are in the world with the larger community and each other. In our Time for All Ages, we explored that message of, and here's your cue again, I want to know if you were listening, we are more alike than different. However, in life there are times when how we are different or how we self-identify may not be perceived or seen by others, and we want to be seen for being wholly ourselves. We want to be known as the complex individuals that we are. I know you know what I mean when I say being witnessed in the most non-judgmental, compassionate ways offer us opportunities as people to not only change our brain wiring, but to enter into relationship in our most joyous selves. What better place to do this work but in the spiritual community of Unitarian Universalism? I believe this is the work of our faith. Growing up, my family was Episcopal on Sunday. I was Catholic Monday through Friday at school. And some evenings, my mother read me Bible stories, but preempted them with things like, "You know, Donna, these are just stories to learn by. And Jesus wasn't really born in the winter." With an Episcopal and Catholic upbringing tinged with a humanist interpretation of the Bible, it makes perfect sense to find that I'm Unitarian Universalist. I learned a lot growing up. Some of it was helpful and some not so helpful. From Mount Marcy Elementary School, I learned to swear in French, which was sometimes helpful. I learned that friendship wasn't about who had the coolest outfit, since we all wore the same one, and that was a good lesson to learn. It was not helpful to learn, however, that if you learned differently than schools taught, that it meant you weren't trying hard enough. And it was this last lesson that carried to me being perceived through many years of my elementary school, junior high, and high school as being perceived as someone who just wasn't trying hard enough. If I had tried harder, I would be able to get the spelling words down. I'd be able to understand the math. And indeed, as every child does, I wanted to succeed. So I tried, and I tried, and I tried. It really didn't seem to make a dent, though, however. What I learned from my guidance counselor in high school was that I wasn't smart enough to go to college, which came up pretty directly when he told me not to bother to apply. And I probably would had not applied, but I learned some other stuff from my mother about being stubborn. And so thank goodness for that, I applied anyway. So with some trepidation and determination, I set off to my first year in college, bound and determined to prove him wrong. It was the driving force in my first year. It was quite a motivator, but now I can think of better. What I've come to understand now, which I didn't then, was that I probably had an undiagnosed learning disability. That would have been good to know. What I also understand now that I didn't then was that my guidance counselor had some categorical thinking going on of his own about what it meant for students with less than stellar grades and success. And so there we meet, the experience itself. You might be wondering, first of all, which schools they were so you don't send your children there. It was in Maine, so I think you're safe. You might also be thinking, that wouldn't happen anymore. So let me share a story with you. As lead facilitator, my job really is just to try to iron out the details, which I do through numerous emails, usually, and some phone calls. And so with this particular congregation, I did that. However, I missed the search committee meeting the night before. But what I heard from my colleague was that they wondered if I was educated. They asked him at the meeting. Now, they weren't really curious about my education per se. They wanted to know if I was smart enough to do the job. Now, you might be thinking, maybe in that congregation, but not here. And I challenge you to consider when I shared this story in yet another congregation and had a congregant come up to me after the service and tell me, she happened to be a guidance counselor, and she said, you must have misunderstood him. I'm sure he had another reason for telling you not to apply to college. And so it really is pretty pervasive, some of these thoughts. And her response was really just one other way of not witnessing me, not seeing me for wholly my experience. The other part you should know is I really don't think that all guidance counselors are bad. I think, indeed, I happened to get the one guy who probably in our whole district maybe was a little burnt out. And most guidance counselors, I think, do a terrific job helping youth launch into the future. Mine, however, didn't. We all internalize messages from our lives. They impact how we lead our lives and how we live our principles. They are the lens with which we view what it means to be you and me. When we deconstruct some of these barriers, we open ourselves up to richer relationships and decisions. What can we all do that allows us to bring ourselves and invite others to bring themselves more authentically into relationship? Whether you are in search or not, this is a fundamental question. And indeed, Jackie and I invite you following lunch to continue with that discussion. Amen and blessed be. I invite you now to stand as you're willing and able to sing the hymn found in your order of service, How Could Anyone? And the first time singing it through, I'll invite you to look at the words if you're not familiar. And the second time through, I'd invite you to sing to your neighbor.
Tell you were anything less than beautiful. How could anyone ever tell you were less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? How deeply you're connected to my soul. How could anyone ever tell you you were anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell you you were less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? How deeply you're connected to my soul.
What a willing group you are. Thank you. That is a song that is very special to me, and it's become very special for Donna and I, who've worked together several times, lots of times. And I was moved to tears when, not only when she invited me to her wedding, but that when I saw that that song was part of her wedding. So it's a wonderful song. Try to practice it a few more times and sing it some more. I am the Jackie of the Donna and Jackie. It does sound funny. And I am absolutely thrilled to be with you in this space, in this place, on this day. Now, what I usually do is not what I've been doing lately, so I'm asking your forgiveness ahead of time for something I'm about to do. You see, for these BCT services, I usually talk about the ways that we have and have not been taught to see one another in this country. Sometimes I do that using literary examples while weaving in historical tidbits and personal experiences in UU houses of worship and in committee meetings. Sometimes I hold up contemporary events to historical ones and ask if we really want to keep repeating those cycles. For you, I wanted to build upon the story that Donna shared earlier on how we're more alike than different. For me, I wanted to use some of what I heard in a friend's spoken word piece based on the God Memorandum in Og Mandino's The Greatest Miracle in the World. He talks of the over 500 muscles and 200 bones and 7 miles of nerves in the human that we share just beneath our respective skins. Our skin replenishes and renews itself even as we age. It holds 4 million pain sensors, 500,000 touch sensors, and 200,000 sensors that are able to detect temperature. Within this skin, we have a brain that weighs a mere 3 pounds, yet holds 13 billion nerve cells. We have 600 million pockets of folded flesh that interacts to allow us to breathe the atmosphere that our own actions make more hazardous every day. And at the center of it all, we have a heart that year after year pumps over 600,000 gallons of blood through a network of thousands of miles of arteries and veins while beating 36 million times a year. Stories from my life as Donna's could provide some insight into how these ways we are the same generally. But most of the time, people look to find the difference. Sometimes they do it intentionally, and sometimes not. Now, after attending the celebration to mark the 60th rotation of my Earth around, of the Earth? No, of my being on the Earth. I tell you, I'm doing things weirdly. But I'm 60 years old this month. A friend stated what a good time he had had, and that the participants included the young and old, black and white, the blind and the lame. To fully fit within our BCT theme, there were also bisexual, gay, and lesbian people present. Now, Joel and Donna reminded you of the workshop that we're going to be facilitating after the service, and I'd like to extend my own invitation for you to join in the conversation. While this program is part of the Beyond Categorical thinking part of the search committee. The work, as Donna says, extends beyond the committee, beyond the standing committee, and hopefully beyond the walls of Theodore Parker. I said I was going to do something unlike what I usually do, and now this is it. Instead of reading more of my own words, I'm going to read something by Emmanuel Ortiz, a self-described third-generation Chicano, Puerto Rican, Irish-American community organizer and spoken word artist who's published several books and is a founding member of Palabristas, a collective of Latino poets in Minnesota. Though he currently lives in Fort Wayne, which he claims is the buckle of the Bible Belt. Now, just to let you know, this piece was written probably about a decade ago. It's called Moment of Silence. However, it could have been written just last week. And I'm using my Kindle, which has decided to change font on me. Before I begin this poem, I'd like to ask you to join me in a moment of silence in honor of those who died in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. I would also like you to offer up a moment of silence for all of those who have been harassed, imprisoned, disappeared, tortured, raped, or killed in retaliation for those strikes, for the victims of in Afghanistan, Iraq, in the U.S., and throughout the world. And if I could just add one more thing, a full day of silence for the tens of thousands of Palestinians who have died at the hands of U.S.-backed Israeli forces over decades of occupation. 6 months of silence for the 1.5 million Iraqi people, mostly children, who've died of malnourishment or starvation as a result of a 12-year U.S. embargo against that country. And now the drums of war beat again. Before I begin this poem, 2 months of silence for the blacks under apartheid in South Africa, where Homeland Security made them aliens in their own country. 9 months of silence for the dead in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where death rained down and peeled back every layer of concrete, steel, earth, and skin, and the survivors went on as if alive. 1 year of silence for the millions of dead in Vietnam, a people, not a war, for those who know a thing or two about the scent of burning fuel, their relatives burned, their relatives' bones buried in it, their babies born of it. 2 months of silence for the decades of dead in Colombia, whose names, like the corpses they once represented, have piled up and slipped off our tongues. Before I begin this poem, 7 days of silence for El Salvador, 1 day of silence for Nicaragua, 5 days of silence for the Guatemaltecos, none of whom ever knew a moment of peace in their living years. 45 seconds of silence for the 45 dead at Actual Chiapas, 1,933 miles of silence for every desperate body that burns in the desert sun, drowned in swollen rivers at the pearly gates to the empire's underbelly, a gaping wound sutured shut by razor wire and corrugated skill. 25 years of silence for the millions of Africans who found their graves far deeper in the ocean than any building could poke into the sky, for those who were strung and swung from the heights of sycamore trees in the south, the north, the east, the west. There will be no DNA testing or dental records to identify their remains. 100 years of silence for the hundreds of millions of indigenous people from this half of right here, whose land and lives were stolen in postcard perfect plots like Pine Ridge, Wounded Knee, Sand Creek, Fallen Timbers, or the Trail of Tears. Names now reduced to innocuous magnetic poetry on the refrigerator of our consciousness. From somewhere within the pillars of power, you open your mouth to invoke a moment of our silence, and we are all left speechless, our tongues snatched from our mouths, our eyes stapled shut. A moment of silence, and the poets are laid to rest. The drums disintegrate into dust. Before I begin this poem, you want a moment of silence. You mourn now as if the world will never be the same, and the rest of us hope to hell it won't be. Not like it always has been. because this is not a 9/11 poem. This is a 9/10 poem. It is a 9/9 poem, a 9/8 poem, a 9/7 poem. This is a 1492 poem. This is a poem about what causes poems like this to be written. And if this is a 9/11 poem, then it's a September 11th, 1973 poem for Chile. This is a September 12th, 1977 poem for Stephen Biko in South Africa. This is a September 13th, 1971 poem for the brothers at Attica Prison, New York. This is a September 14th, 1992 poem for the people of Somalia. This is a poem for every date that falls to the ground amidst the ashes of amnesia. This is a poem for the 110 stories that were never told, the 110 stories that history uprooted from its textbooks, the 110 stories that CNN, BBC, The New York Times, and Newsweek ignored. This is a poem for interrupting this program. This is not a peace poem, not a poem for forgiveness. This is a justice poem, a poem for never forgetting. This is a poem to remind us that all that glitters might just be broken glass. And still, you want a moment of silence for the dead? We could give you lifetimes of empty, the unmarked graves, the lost languages, the uprooted trees and histories, the dead stares on the faces of nameless children. Before I start this poem, we could be silent forever, or just long enough to hunger and the dust to bury us. And you would still ask us for more of our silence. So if you want a moment of silence, then stop the oil pumps, turn off the engines, the televisions, sink the cruise ships, crush the stock markets, unplug the marquee lights, delete the emails and instant messages, derail the trains, ground the planes. If you want a moment of silence, put a brick through the window of Taco Bell and pay the workers for wages lost. Tear down the liquor stores, the townhouses, the White Houses, the jailhouses, the penthouses, and the Playboys. If you want a moment of silence, then take it on Super Bowl Sunday, the 4th of July, during Dayton's 13-hour sale, the next time your white guilt fills the room where my beautiful brown people have gathered. You want a moment of silence? Then take it now, before this poem begins. Here in the echo of my voice, in the pause between the goose steps of the second hand, in the space between bodies in embrace, here is your silence. Take it. Take it all. But don't cut in line. Let your silence begin at the beginning of crime. And we, today, we will keep right on singing for our dead.